Concord Orchestra. This is the Edge here. I'll be talking to BP this Saturday at 9 on Radio 2 for the final BP Fallon Orchestra. You better be there. Welcome to Groovydom. Welcome, everyone, to the last BP Fallon Orchestra.
Should BP have old fashioned, even though this is the final one, you might be kind enough to introduce yourself.
Ah, thank you, BP. This is the Edge here. Speaking with B.P. Fallon from RTE Studios, Dublin.
Very historic moment. Edge, can we go to the beginning of your American tour? There was all this controversy about the governor cancelling Martin Luther King Day, etc. And I think people are very vague on exactly what happened. Would you be kind enough to explain it?
Yeah, sure. Well, we arrived in Phoenix in Arizona and picked up the paper 2 days before we were to do our first show on the first part of our American tour, and read to our horror that there was a few concerts had been stopped. There was one in particular by the Doobie Brothers which had been pulled. It was a charity show, and they'd pulled out because of the governor of Arizona, this guy called Meekum, who had pulled out the holiday set aside to commemorate Martin Luther King.
This is the holiday that Stevie Wonder inaugurated.
Yeah, which everybody worked so hard to get instated in the first place, and it was like a real blow to have it reneged in that way. He was using excuses like it was the actual previous governor had gone about it the wrong way. But, I mean, reading between the lines, it was pretty much that the guy was just this fascist asshole who was going to pull the holiday because he just didn't feel that Black civil rights was a good enough reason to have a holiday. So we were in this kind of embarrassing situation, having written a song like Pride in the Name of Love, having expressed our feelings about Martin Luther King quite publicly. We couldn't sit by and just do the shows, even though we found out about it almost too late to do anything. So what we did, in fact, was create a bit of a press sensation by gathering together all the press people that were in town for the opening of our tour, making a press statement to the effect that we were supporting the Meekum Watchdog Committee, which is this independent political pressure group that was set up to basically see the guy off. We are making donations to the Meekum.
To see the governor off?
Yeah. To have him impeached. There was this Impeach Meekum campaign, or Meekum for ex-governor. So we got right in there and started making a bit of a fuss, and because all the press happened to be there, and because I suppose it was a perfect news story to hang their stories on at the start of the U2 tour and the whole controversy about the Phoenix thing, they all went for it like mad. And we heard about 2 weeks later that there's all sorts of things are being pulled out of Phoenix and Arizona as a result, and that a neighboring state has actually thought twice about rescinding the Martin Luther King Day as a result of what happened to Arizona.
Wow. And was there any suggestions that in fact you shouldn't have played at all?
Well, I think had we heard about it in time, we may have considered not playing. But as luck would have it, by playing, we did so much more than we could have done by staying away, that I'm very glad we did play in the end. And so are the Meekum Watchdog Committee. I'm sure all the Black civil rights people in America.
Yeah. That brings us to this question, which when you guys in the past have been asked, what are you two? You know, the answer has come forth, well, we're a rock and roll band. But you're not really a rock and roll band, certainly in terms of something like Bon Jovi or Duran Duran. Do you have a kind of a description of you two that doesn't actually just end with a rock and roll band?
Well, rock and roll is the sort of beginning and end of what you two is about. But I think Woody Guthrie said there's music to live to and there's music to die to. And I suppose we fall into the first category, music to live to. It's music that deals with everyday things that everyday people experience and go through. And it's not into escapism, it's not into embroidering the truth. It presents it as it is. But at the same time, there is some kind of hope, some faith in humanity involved in it, which is something I think Woody Guthrie's music had. Compare that to Champagne for Two on Park Avenue, which is like what most of rock and roll is about.
Rock and roll, really?
Yeah, it's kind of escapist. It's all, everything's rosy as long as you can afford a bottle of Dom Perignon 58. And it's just pretty much, I mean, in terms of lyrics anyway, it's a heap of bullshit. The actual feeling of rock and roll might be there, but that's never been enough for me. I mean, I like that, but I've always gone a bit deeper than that.
And how do you work that emotionally and spiritually and mentally? You're just sort of like talking about the people, the sort of the Dom Perignon mentality and the candy floss type music and everything. And at the same time, when you're touring and traveling around and everything, you do it on quite a expansive level, don't you? I mean, your own plane and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, we do now because we can afford to do it because we're playing sellout shows in America. And to be honest, whatever we can do to make touring that little bit easier, we will do, because what tends to happen is the shows start to suffer if you're wiped out by traveling kind of 48 hours in a bus when you could be actually on a plane doing the journey in 3 hours, getting a decent night's sleep. I mean, the plane is not a kind of 747. It's an old Viscount.
Well, that's not a Starship type job, no?
Well, I love it. In fact, I prefer it to a 747, but it's not exactly the lap of the gods, so to speak. It's pretty funky and rock and roll in its own way. As far as, you know, backstage and all that goes, it's like we just look after people as we hope we'd be looked after at other shows. You know, plenty of refreshments, etc. But I don't think it's ever wasteful or in any sense inappropriate for the situation. We just try and do things properly and make it as easy for ourselves to be in good shape for the shows as we can.
Right. Well, I was very lucky, as you know, or you may not know I was lucky, but I was lucky anyway. I saw you guys in a couple of shows in America lately. And on one of them, the one in Hartford, Connecticut, you started off, a record was playing, this next record we're going to hear. And then you guys came on and sort of continued the record, but live on stage. So you might be kind enough to explain, first of all, the theory about that and tell us why you like this gentleman.
Well, we were backstage at one of the shows, and this song was on. The song is Stand By Me by John Lennon. We played it every night before we went on stage. And we just felt, let's get out there, let's start playing along. We didn't know the chords, so it was a bit of a panic to try and fit in without embarrassing yourself totally. And we just played a few verses. Bono sang a verse, I sang a verse, and we just turned the record off and just carried on for about 5 minutes, doing our own little improvised version of the song, and then just went back into our set with the lights still up, the house lights still up. So it was a totally different kind of opening. It really took everyone by surprise, including ourselves. But it's a song, I think, that really says it all for me. I mean, John Lennon's always been a bit of a hero, and this is like one of his best moments, I think.
Here it is. There you go, folks. That's the good doctor, Dr. Winston O'Boogie, and Stand By Me, and sitting here in the final BPFO is The Edge from U2. When I was listening to Larry talking to Dave Felling on Dave's show, mm-hmm. And he chose, or they were talking about, I forget which, Working Class Hero, John Lennon song.
Yeah.
And Larry said that he was more familiar, he'd gotten familiar with that song through Marianne Faithfull.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seems you guys have been kind of going backwards, as it were.
Yeah, that's true in a way. Well, you know, when 76 happened, it was kind of a big fuck off to anything that happened before then, and it really wasn't hip to be into anything before then, you know, before the Pistols, the Clash, and all those bands. And it's really in the last couple of years that we're starting to look back and see exactly what was going on of value before that that explosion happened in 76. Because really, I didn't really know exactly where I stood on that. I mean, I knew that a lot of the stuff was awful, but at the same time, the early stuff was incredible. I mean, it makes a mockery of what's going down on the radio right now for sheer energy and vitality and just spunk.
And what do you think about the current state of pop music and rock and roll and stuff?
It's just awful. I mean, it's unbelievably bad. You switch on the radio and it's depressing, you know. I'm in my car, I switch on the radio, it's like after a couple of songs I just hit the button, there's nothing. Certainly during the day, until your show comes on BP.
You're very kind. We'll have a little announcement about that maybe towards the end of this this Edge sketch.
But generally pretty bad. Especially in England. I mean, there's some stuff coming through in America, but England is really the end at the moment.
Well, what do you think is the answer to that?
I think more rock and roll bands and less kind of disco music, which seems to be controlled not by the artists or the singers, but by whoever wrote the song, whoever signed the band to the label. It's sort of taking it away from the street where rock and roll belongs and into the kind of boardroom, which I always think is a mistake. I want to see more young bands coming through in England and Ireland and in America. In order to do that, there has to be more venues, etc., and all that.
And is there anything that you guys can do about that, then?
Well, yeah, I mean, there is stuff we can do. We're seeing about it right now, but it's always difficult to, as Pete Townsend said, he said to us, look, leave the social work to the old guys like me. You know, what you've got to do is just make sure that you write good songs and have hit records and, you know, just make sure that what you do is right, because I think what he was saying is what he spent a lot of his early successful years trying to make his friends successful, working on things that really were less important than just getting the next Who record together.
Explain that. I'm not quite with you.
Well, I mean, everybody's got a certain amount of energy, and if you blow it as an artist, If you squander your skill and your talent and your shot at making something really worthwhile on vinyl by just trying to get involved in things not really on the point, then that's a real shame. Your responsibility. I mean, I feel right now with you two, we've been given a chance at doing something great, and I feel like our responsibility is to just do as well as we can. Obviously, if we can work our way around to helping everyone at the moment, we will, no question. But I think our time for getting into the social work, etc., and really working to try and improve things for bands generally will come maybe in a couple of years when we can lay back a bit and spend a bit more time in that and not working on records, working on tours, working on songwriting.
Right.
So we kind of have to earn the breathing space to go and do all that. If we were to try and take a year off now to do a Bob Geldof or something, the whole thing would just fall apart.
And you're saying your profile would suffer, and therefore...
Well, the music would suffer, songs would suffer, the albums would suffer, and the tours would suffer. I mean, this U2 is taking every ounce of my energy and mental capacity right now. I know if I was to try and do anything... I mean, my whole life is in shreds. Everything about me, apart from the band, is suffering right now. But I know that that's what I've got to do. That's what we've all got to do, because that's it's really the chance we've been given to do this. And if we mess up, we'll feel pretty stupid in another 5 years.
Right. Well, I'd like to touch back on that in a minute, but I think maybe we'll have a little bit of music. Can you tell us about your feelings towards Jimi Hendrix, Bessin?
Mm. Well, Jimi was one of the main men early on. I mean, when I was like grown up, like 12 or 13, he was like it. And really, it's second time around again for me that I'm really seeing exactly how far ahead of the posse he was. And there's still a lot that I can learn as a guitar player from listening to him. As simple as it was, what he could say with electric guitar was... what he couldn't say wasn't worth saying, I think.
Right, well, yes.
And Bullet the Blue Sky, I think, owes a lot to his approach to communicating to the instrument.
Right, well, here he is. Here is Jimi with one of his most underrated and one of his best tracks ever. Jimi plays the blues, Red House. Pretty cool, Jimi. That's the Jimi Hendrix Experience, Red House, and we've got Edge here in the final BPFL. Edge, before we played that piece of music, you were saying that your family life was in rags and everything because of your commitment to U2. How does that work, in fact? Because you're the only gentleman in the combo who's got children and everything like that. Is it a situation whereby if decisions are made that the band comes first? Oh.
Impossible question to really answer, because it's not never that simple. I mean, when I make a decision, I make it for Ashley, for myself and for the kids. I don't think of myself as separate. But part of the decision-making process is the realization that I have got dependents that I've got to think in terms of. So it never comes to a clear-cut sort of the band or my family situation. When I said my family life was in rags, what I really meant was kind of my house is falling down with just total neglect. I mean, the number of letters I haven't opened, leave alone answered, the bills just piling up. I mean, just this total lack of organization there. But I mean, the people, I mean, my wife and kids are not suffering as such, because they come with me on tour and they see quite a lot of me. But still, it's life is in a state of constant turmoil and flux because of the way the band is at the moment. And things change all the time, and life is not really normal right now. I mean, I hope it can become a bit more normal at the end of the tour, but right now it's like total madness.
Because you two are one of the, if not the only band who I know of, I'm sure they're not the only one that comes to mind right now, who actually more than welcome their loved ones coming on tour with them.
Yeah, actually, we play better shows if, you know, folks are around, wives and girlfriends are there. Tends to take a little pressure off the show, you know, because often when we're alone on tour, certainly at the beginning of the tour, it has to be that way. But if we've been playing for a couple of weeks and we're in good shape musically, it's at that stage that if we didn't kind of break away from the intensity of the post-mortems after shows, etc., it would all start to lose some of the fun. And it's nice to just get away from our intensity. Because together, you know, the four of us are so we're on top of everything, you know, musically. We're really on top of the whole thing the whole time. And you can get a little kind of crazy just concentrating so much on one thing. You just start to froth at the mouth and, you know, people...
Has that ever happened to you? Have you ever gone a bit loopy because of all the rock and roll sketch?
You start... Oh, yeah, I mean, the old mind starts going a bit funny. You start doing interviews and you start talking total crap. It's really quite funny. And it's like tour madness is what we call it. And you know, there's this glazed look over the eyes, and you start, you're wandering around airport lobbies, being shunted from one cafe to the next and then onto the plane.
Like a moron.
Totally zombified, no sense of direction or what you're up to at all. So it's good to kind of break free from the sort of concentration.
Because as well, you see, you don't have that thing that a lot of groups have, where they're sort of drug crazed and stuff like that. You've never been a drug orientated group, really, have you?
Chocolate, yes, but drugs, no.
Yeah. I mean, how does that work in America? Because I mean, I've been on tour there and stuff, and people sort of say have this, have that, and things like that. Or does everyone know by now that you two aren't really that interested?
I don't know, to be honest. Sometimes Adam might become targeted as the only potential bad boy, but in fact, Adam's probably better than the rest of us now, to be honest. Like, he's getting early nights and we're up. I mean, yeah, I suppose we grew up in an era when we saw the result of drug abuse, and not just in people we admire, rock and roll bands, but also people on the street, you know. I knew people down the road from me in Malahide who just blew their brains out with acid or whatever happened to be going around at the time. And it's not funny, you know, see these talented, intelligent blokes who just sort of basket cases. And you start to think, you know, if that happens, you know, when you get wrapped up in that thing, certainly I'm not going to do it because I have too much to do. I can't afford to be a kind of semi-conscious member of society. I've got... You know, we were determined from the beginning to make this thing go somewhere, and we just felt, well, I'm not going to get into that.
Because it's very, very unusual, as you know.
Well, I'm not sure how unusual it is now. I mean, obviously a lot of groups, I mean, this degree, I mean, in anything, and one can dabble without getting seriously damaged, but I think that's what's happening now, is people have copped on that it's something you just have to have a healthy respect for, and if they do mess about, they know it's something that they, for instance, they don't overdo, and they stay clear of H, for instance, which is like...
That kills people.
The end. I suppose the people are less ignorant now than they were, which is good. They understand exactly what's going on. I get very angry when I hear about kids, like, before they really know about it, getting involved, because that's really evil when you've got a sort of 12-year-old kid who's getting into heroin or something and he hasn't a clue what he's up to. At least when we got into the band, we were sort of 16, 17, we pretty much knew what the score was, and we could make some sort of rational decision on it.
Right. Let's have a little bit of bluegrass here.
Great.
No, do you ever listen to it at all?
Bluegrass. I love country music generally. Bluegrass is something I'm only getting into now. It's. I think it's an instrumentation and feel. It's got a real Irish quality to it. You know, violins and all that.
All right, so here we go. This is Bill Monroe and Chums and a live version of Blue Moon of Kentucky. There you are, folks. That's Lester Flatt and Bill Monroe and Blue Moon of Kentucky. Can we talk about when you're traveling in America and stuff like that? Do you ever watch the old television there, Edge, and stuff?
Well, I try to avoid it if I possibly can, but occasionally... no, honestly, the first couple of tours we did, we came back sounding like we came from America. The music had a bit of a sort of American rock influence. And, like, this was the stuff... Most of it didn't actually make albums because we copped on in time, but... It's a very insidious influence, I think, American media generally. So for the last couple of tours, I've been watching minimum of TV in America because it's just so bad.
Now, can you explain to the... You say it's insidious. Can you develop that?
Well, the media generally in America is a lot to ask for, I think. I mean, the press is very kind of local, parochial, and... I think very supportive of a certain side of American power, the sort of right-wing side. You hear stories about journalists in Central America sending home stories about what was going on in Nicaragua and the copy being changed to contradict the facts or what they had in fact reported. You hear about the playlisting on radio where, I mean, for instance, your show would never exist in America. There's maybe a handful of stations in the whole country that have a playlist larger than maybe 40 records at one time.
Mm-hmm.
So you could forget about anything as diverse as this. It would all be kind of top 40 albums, etc. And that's about it. WBCN in Boston's one station. It's kind of totally untypical because it like you have that freedom on your show. They've got shows there where they can play what they want. As far as TV goes, it's the lowest common denominator to the nth degree. Some of the most frightening TV is in America, the TV evangelist stuff, where you get these complete kind of charlatans just coming on the airwaves, just begging for money, and it's all down to pound shillings and pence, as far as I can see. There's nothing honorable or spiritual about it. It's all just a scam. They're just in the big business. There's a bit of a scandal going on in America at the moment. You probably heard about the Jim Baker scandal. This guy who was exposed by another TV evangelist. This isn't that just typical. It's kind of dog eat dog out there. these guys are at each other's throats to try and
better each other.
Get the supremacy on TV networks. But they earn a fortune.
I think Becker was had up for $92 million.
Yeah.
Went sideways.
You know, it's incredible. And they have all these enormous monuments built in their name, you know, the big glass temples or whatever. It's so far from anything real or worthwhile. It's just awful. The worst is I saw this show where the guy was actually claiming that any kind of miracle you wanted to happen, just send the guy $100 and he guaranteed it would actually happen. And not only that, he went so far as to say that there is a curse for disobedience in this. If you don't send me $100, you know, your head will drop off or your house will burn down or something. I mean, these guys are nutcases. They really should be brought to account, I think.
Yeah, because I saw one of those shows after I saw you guys. I went down to Miami and there was a show on there, which apparently is all over America, called Praise the Lord. And it was a fierce, abusive, very good idea. And I'd like to dedicate this next record to all those people. This is Paul Kelly, Stealing in the Name of the Lord. Whoa. That's Paul Kelly there, folks, Stealing in the Name of the Lord. And sitting here in the last BPFO is The Edge. Edge, when you travel around, and because of the position the band are in now, or maybe because people like the band simply, and apart from the position of how successful you are, you get to meet all these people. All these people come to meet you too, like Bob Dylan and Elvis Costello and stuff like that. Tell us about that. I mean, I know that you guys played with him, or he played with you on the last tour. What was that like, first of all?
Oh, it was really good. I mean, whenever somebody like Elvis or Bob Dylan comes around, we immediately thrust an acoustic guitar into their hands to try and steal some of their songwriting ideas. I mean, we're still learning how to write songs, so it's a kind of workshop, you know. How do you do that, Bob, you know? We wrote a couple of songs, actually, with Bob and Elvis, kind of late-night hotel room affairs where the lyrics were scribbled on the back of a room service menu, and the verse and choruses were kind of hummed into a little cassette machine. So we lost the cassette of the one we did with Bob Dylan. So
no, where'd that go?
Well, we think we might have found it again. It was just a song I was working on acoustic, and we just started tossing it around, and T-Bone was there as well.
T-Bone Burnett?
Yeah. We just started working on some verses for it. And with Elvis, I wasn't there actually at the time, but this bar just started swapping a few chords. It's something apparently that was a traditional thing to do between groups, but up until now we've never done it because we never wrote songs in that way. But we're getting more and more into that. You know, we know a few chords now, and it's happening for us.
Were you a bit embarrassed about that before, then, the lack of technical skill and stuff?
Well, we just realized not to put ourselves in that situation because there was no way we could have done it, you know. But because the way we used to write songs, in fact, the way we write to this day, a lot of the material is like the four members of the band playing together and it's working on music. And that music is then molded into some kind of a shape that would take a vocal. And Mama just starts singing, working on melodies, and we take it from there. So it's much more of an evolved thing rather than a really strict set up verse, chorus, middle, right, format, which I think a lot of people write in using maybe piano or acoustic.
And what are these songs like? I mean, the stuff you did with Dylan and the stuff you did with Elvis, I mean, is it kind of like early morning, dawn coming, 12-bar gibberish, or is it quite good?
Well, I seem to be leaning more and more towards a kind of country style in my writing. Primarily, I think, because acoustic guitar lends one in that area. It always does with me. Piano and electric guitar, I think, produce more of the kind of sound or style of song that we're more well known for. But acoustic, whenever I pick up an acoustic, it always comes out country. So the one we were working on with Dylan was another kind of country song. I've got about half a dozen country songs that I'm working on right now, from just late nights in hotel rooms across America. Of course, that's the perfect place to work on a song like that. Las Vegas in particular. We did a few nights in Las Vegas, and that was a real experience.
Tell us about that.
Well, it's like you can't believe that people can be so stupid. That's the first thing. You know, all around them is the evidence of a million losers that have been that path before them. These enormous casinos, these fantastically sumptuous hotels. I mean, how they can't cop that this is, you know, this is all sponsored by people coming along with their life savings and blowing it all on the roulette wheel. As far as the color of the place goes, it's one of the most strange places you'll ever see in your life. The whole thing is just neon from one end to the next, and it never stops. We shot a video on the streets of Las Vegas starting at about 3 o'clock, and we ended at dawn, and people were milling around the whole time. It was as if it was daylight. The neon, in fact, was so bright that it might as well have been daylight.
And were there a lot of people wounded by gambling?
Not visibly. I think they'd be cleaned up every Monday morning and shuttled out of town. But you could definitely see some pretty freaked out people hanging around. I think what a lot of people just arrived when, you know, were broke within a couple of weeks and got jobs. So there's all these sort of weird looking dudes working at a casino.
I didn't make the million.
Yeah, you not only didn't make the million, but didn't have enough money to get home.
Well, we're joined here by a former colleague of Edge's for the BPFO. I thought we might have a sort of a super special live vibe. Steve Wickham, you're very welcome.
Thanks very much, Steve.
How are you doing?
Very well.
So I see you have your fiddle there.
Uh-huh.
Do you reckon you might do something with it?
I'd be pleasure as an honour.
Brilliant. Yeah. Tell us what it is before you launch into it.
I play a jig. Play a little jig called the butterfly. I think it's called the butterfly. God only knows.
Like with him on the road, Edge. You had a kind of an extended band, didn't you, with around the time of...
That's right, yeah,
war.
The European tour, we had the guys on the road. Well, to be honest, we couldn't afford to do it in any style, so it was a question of Steve would just happen to be in Sweden or Holland or whatever, and we'd drag him onto stage. But it was great, you know, the extended lineup idea, I think, really does work. If you've got somebody like Steve who knows what it's all about, you know, because you can put violin players on stage and it would just look all wrong, but Steve always really worked visually.
Welcome to the BPFO Edge and Steve Wickham promo show, folks. Well, I agree with you absolutely, Edge, actually. I do, I really do.
Those European tours, though, were really difficult because it was really scraping the barrel time. You know, the hotels are always one step up from Doss houses, and the coach was breaking down continually, and the best times we ever had was getting the train, as we used to do when people got really depressed, was get these sleeper trains to go from Scandinavia to, say, Holland or something like that.
And how does that work? I mean, I suppose at the time you weren't kind of as famous and stuff, no?
Oh, no. That's the thing about you two. Like, a lot of people in America especially think it's kind of happened over the last 2 years, and, you know, a lot of people, like, this guy came up to me the other week, he said, I've been into you since the very beginning, you know, since Unforgettable Fire. And he thought, like, this is our first record. And the Joshua Tree was number two. And I had to explain to him that we'd been actually on our own records for 7 years. And, you know, I mean, not to stress the point, but we have, in a sense, paid our dues by doing many tours up and down the M1 in the transit van and across Europe and across America and their equivalents.
Yeah.
I mean, they're years I wouldn't swap, because they're incredible as far as just to see a country through the windshield of a van is it's a great way to see it.
And how does it work when you're walking around and stuff like that? I mean, the other day, Bono and Adam came down to see the water boys playing on Sirius, the Greenpeace ship.
Yeah.
And it was lovely, actually, to do, you know, the old autograph and everything, but there was no sort of mayhem and stuff like that. It was really nice. Is it like that in the rest of the world, or is it a bit more weird?
It tends to vary a lot. Like, Japan is totally ridiculous. You know, you get followed by 1,000 15-year-olds everywhere you go. You know, you walk down the street, it's just like, it looks like you're leading a school trip down to the record shop or something. America's not too bad, but Los Angeles tends to be pretty bad. It's you know, varies a lot. You just got to learn what you can and cannot do in a particular town. I mean, there's certain things I wouldn't do here, but...
Like what?
Oh, like drop into a convent at lunchtime or something like that, or go out to see them on a Saturday afternoon, something like that. But, I mean, pretty much everything else is fine. In America, you just make sure that if you go out anywhere, you confuse them enough by dressing in a way that they don't associate with you. Like, if I wear a hat in America, forget it. But if ever I, you know, as I am today, just walk down the street without the hat, then no one really bothers you.
Wow. Because Christy Moore's the reverse. When he waves his little woolen berry walking around, people don't notice him as much as when he's without it, you know?
Yeah. It's all kind of what you're known best in. People recognize you.
And you get sometimes strange people with sort of say, look, here I am, and I've come to save you with my philosophy of life and stuff like that, and laying all kinds of tricks on you.
That happens a lot. And also you get guys kind of saying, you owe me money. I'm sure you've ripped off my song. I sent you a demo tape in 1975, and, you know, like, lunatics come up to you all the time and want money and stuff. I mean, it's... Especially in the States, you get these nutcases. They're all over the place.
What do you do?
You just humour them and just get out of there fast. That's all you can do, really.
Mm. Is there anything that that you aspire to that you haven't gotten yet?
Plenty, much too much to outline in one interview like this. I mean, most of our aspirations are musical ones, you know. To pick up an instrument like that and just play like what Steve did there is something I'd like to be able to do. And I know I can't do that right now, because what we do is very specialized. I mean, you know, as you too, we can certainly go out there and perform probably as well as anyone around, but our musicianship is so specialized. I think, you know, my ambition is to make it much broader, so we could go into a bar and just
skiffle out.
Yeah. Just get up there and play a few songs. I think that's a great thing to be able to do. And it's, you know, we're doing it. Like, on this tour, we took over an old country and western bar and did a few old Hank Williams songs and a couple of things. I did Lost Highway. A great old
Hank. I want to make a quick announcement here before we get up to 10 o'clock, actually, and this is the last BPFO, and also my last Sunday show was last Sunday, but in fact I'm not actually departing this ship, the RTD2 ship. I'm going to be playing on Groovy Records every Saturday for 2 hours from 8 to 10.
Oh, that's great news.
Yeah, I'm delighted, actually. I'm really delighted, because at one point I was quite freaked out, as they say. I'd like to just ask you the final question, actually. You've had all this enormous success and everything, and you're very happy with your family. Are you generally a happy chap?
Well, you know the way they say that a lot of comics are quite morose generally? Well, in fact, I think the opposite is true of you too. Although a lot of our music can be quite black, I think that in a sense it's a form of exorcism. So I'd say generally, yeah, my outlook is pretty optimistic.
Brilliant.
You know, coming home from America, we've been told that Ireland was very depressed. But I tell you, since I got here, it's been just great to be here.
Well, it's great having you here in the final BPFO. And Steve, thank you very much for coming down and fitting in a little bit. Steve Edge, thank you very much. God bless you. God bless you for listening.